Before the whirring cameras of media from all over New England, Assistant Attorney General Jane Young laid out the timeline. At 4:04, Stephen Arkell was sent to respond to a verbal domestic dispute between 86-year-old Walter Nolan and his 47-year-old son, Michael.
The caller indicated that they could hear the son swearing at the father, but that the argument was taking place in the house. There was also an indication that although the police had never been called before, that this individual had heard arguing before.
Investigators say at this time they have no evidence of criminal records, mental health problems, or even motor vehicle violations for either. When Officer Arkell arrived at the scene, Walter Nolan let him in. Officials believe he was met with gunfire from the son, Michael Nolan.
It certainly seemed that Officer Arkell walked into a situation that he didn't anticipate. Again, you know, this is a pretty quiet town. It's 4:00 on a Monday. You know, as somebody said, this doesn't happen here.
Police don't know if Arkell had a chance to draw his weapon. Just minutes later, a second officer, Derek Franick from Fremont, arrived at the scene. Police say he handcuffed Walter Nolan outside of the house after he was unable or unwilling to respond to questions. Franick, who knew shots had been fired, then entered the house only to see a wall that had been peppered with bullets and Officer Arkell's body lying face up. Police say Officer Franick determined that Arkell was already dead, but before he could recover the body, Michael Nolan again opened fire.
He indicated that he immediately was met with gunfire. That gunfire drove him from the front of the house to the back of the house, where he was able to escape off the deck and he went to the tree line.
Franick was uninjured and called for backup.
You know, the courage that he had to walk into that situation alone, try to do what he could to help his fellow officer get out and then call for backup is heroic.
More police began to arrive, setting up a perimeter around the house. And 20 minutes after Franick's call for help, smoke began to billow from the home.
Like many kids with autism, Hunter Picknell has trouble expressing himself.
His primary form of communication is sign language, but there's certain things he can't do with his hands and fingers because of his motor planning issues. So he makes kind of his own sign language. It's very idiosyncratic. We often joke around and say that it's sign language with an accent.
Hunter's mother, Melissa Hilton, says when the 9-year-old can't share what he's thinking or feeling, he gets frustrated. That frustration can trigger violent outbursts and dangerous behavior, like smashing his head against the floor or wall. These eruptions caused problems at Hunter's elementary school. He had a one-on-one education aid, but sometimes he'd have meltdowns. When no one could get him to stop, he'd be left alone in the classroom.
They would just watch him through this tiny window like he was a rabid monkey, and instead of comforting him when he was upset, they'd just lock him in this room so he couldn't get out.
Using seclusion or physical restraint is supposed to be a last resort when a child is in danger of hurting himself or others. And schools are required to notify parents within 24 hours. Hilton says she wasn't alerted in that time frame, which made it harder to help her son understand what was happening.
When a kid is the subject of some sort of physical intervention or isolation from their peers, that's important for a parent to know.
Mike Skibbe is with the Disabilities Rights Center. Kids with disabilities are 25 times more likely to be restrained, according to the UNH CARSI Institute. That finding is consistent with a federal investigation, which brought national attention to the issue in 2009. It highlighted hundreds of alleged cases across the country, resulting in severe injury and death. New Hampshire rewrote its laws the next year, banning certain techniques and adding the 24-hour reporting requirement. But critically, the law also included an exception. Any restraint that is considered, quote, brief, doesn't need to be reported. In practice, this has led to very few instances inside group homes ever showing up in state filings.
Obviously, you see all these zeros here. It's obviously not the case that all of those organizations had no physical restraints. The exception around it was, frankly, wide enough to drive a truck through.
David Villiotti is executive director of the Nashua Children's Home. It's one of the few residential treatment centers in the state that didn't simply classify every restraint as brief and leave it unreported. Villiotti says his staff is diligent about keeping parents informed, but believes physical restraints are needed in volatile situations.
We know it's serious business. We know whenever we put our hands on kids with the resistance that kids offer, there's the risk of injury, and we know that that can happen. But when we do need to put our hands on kids, that do it in a way that's safe and non-harmful.
One place that reports zero incidents is New Hampshire's juvenile detention facility called the Sununu Center. Maggie Bishop oversees the Division for Juvenile Justice Services.
We document when it happens, and I think that at least weekly and sometimes daily, a child or children have to be separated.
Bishop says parents do get notified even if state officials don't get a write-up. The state is, however, backing a bill moving through the legislature that would make it easier to track the use of restraints. The measure would close the loophole allowing so-called brief restraints to go unreported. It also sets strict guidelines for secluding children and clarifies that neither restraint nor seclusion can be used as punishment. Many close to this issue see this as progress. That includes Eric Herlin, an attorney who represents school districts. He cautions, though, that this is a complicated issue and that the new standards may put too much pressure on educators to record what may amount to normal contact with students.
Our teachers should be teaching kids rather than writing reports.
But advocates argue the tighter standards make clear exceptions for benign exchanges, like a kindergarten teacher hugging a student or a coach interacting with an athlete. And they say making more events reportable will make clear which institutions rely too heavily on potentially dangerous actions against children. Right now, there's no way to know. For NHPR News, I'm Todd Bookman.
Corrections Sergeant Justin Jardine has been working three double shifts, or 64 hours, every week. He just got off work.
So I worked 7 a.m. to 11 p.m., went home, showered, I got to bed around 1, got back up at 6, and was back at work for 7 o'clock this morning.
Younger officers, Jardine says, work more like 4 or 5 double shifts a week. The overtime is forced, meaning if Jardine refuses, he'll be disciplined. And although you can volunteer to work overtime shifts that fit your schedule, often officers only find out they can't go home once they get to work. The money is good. Overtime earns time and a half. A sergeant like Jardine can walk home with almost $70,000 a year. But
no matter how money hungry you are, no one wants to do that for years on end. And it's been years now.
For more than a decade, New Hampshire prisons have been under huge pressure. Prison population has grown while staff has shrunk. In 2004, administrators concluded the Concord Prison for Men needs 371 officers to operate normally. It needs 277 for critical operations. Right now, they're down to 198. Initially, positions were left vacant due to budget cuts across the department. But now, Warden Richard Gary says the problem is finding qualified recruits.
We get a lot of applications, but then putting them through the different steps in a hiring process, a lot either don't show up that have applied, or they don't pass the hiring phases.
There may be a snowball effect, too. The worse the working conditions, the harder it is to convince new folks to sign on. But for Commissioner Bill Wren, the scary part is that this recruitment problem is about to get a lot worse.
Our employees' average age is increasing. And with the increased average age out there, the ability for people to retire is very evident.
Officers can retire as young as age 45, and a 2012 state audit warned the more burned out they are, the more likely it is they'll take their benefits and run. In fact, the department has lost many more officers than they've hired for 5 years running. Governor Hassan says all this overtime is bad news for New Hampshire.
It strains really dedicated state employees, and it strains our budget.
Over the last 4 years, paying overtime has cost the state $3.5 million more than it would have spent paying full-time employees. Governor Hassan says she and Commissioner Wren are trying to fix things.
We have redesigned the process, everything from putting application forms online to making sure that we could pre-schedule the physical agility tests.
The Department of Corrections still has only one employee responsible for recruitment and hiring. But now, 27 staff volunteers are going to job fairs, even making follow-up calls to applicants who fail to show up on test days. But there may be a bigger problem.
New Hampshire's economy is doing well.
A.T. Wall is president of the Association of State Correctional Administrators. He says prison jobs are hard. They require nights and weekends, and they're dangerous. So, of course, people opt for other jobs in a place like New Hampshire, where unemployment is low.
And where correctional officer salaries and benefits lag behind what somebody could make in another position.
Right now, correctional officer salaries start at $33,500. Starting salaries at local police departments are at least $10,000 higher. Policymakers are not talking about immediately boosting salaries, and Governor Hassan says she wants to test the new application process first. But in the meantime, things at the Concord State Prison for Men are not good. Inmate Eric Grant has been here for 24 years on a second-degree murder charge. He says he's found officers who should be watching security cameras dead asleep.
It happens. I'm not going to say all the time, but I mean, in front of him, there could be an assault going on. He wouldn't see it.
Grant says staff cutbacks have consequences. As staffing levels have dropped, inmate assaults have risen 30% during the last decade. Recidivism rates are up 60%. Of course, there's more to those numbers than just staffing. Prisons are overcrowded. There are growing racial tensions and increased drug use. At the same time, treatment programs and classes, even visiting hours and sports have been cut back. As Grant sees it, when it comes to inmates' behavior,
everything's related to everything when it comes down to that.
And with 55 officers becoming eligible for retirement this year, the staffing shortage may get worse before it gets better. For NHPR News, I'm Emily Corwin.
Tara Goering and her husband are moving out of their small apartment in Concord and in with other family members in town. Half-packed cardboard boxes fill the rooms. We sit down in what was their bedroom, as she tells me about Ram Goering, her father.
My dad was very popular in the camps. There were 7 camps, and he was popular among them all. He used to give interviews to local radio stations. People knew him.
At the refugee camp in Nepal, Ram earned the nickname Patrikar Baje, or journalist granddad. He would read newspapers to others who couldn't read. He and his family lived in the refugee camp for about 20 years. Then, this past September 4th, Ram, who was 73 years old, his wife, 2 grown daughters, and son-in-law arrived in New Hampshire.
We never saw any warning signs in him. Even back home, when he heard about somebody attempting suicide, he would counsel them and explain to them that life is beautiful. We never saw him unhappy.
But on Thanksgiving, Ram Goering locked himself in his apartment alone and hanged himself.
At first, when we saw him lying in the bathroom, I felt he was not dead. The first impression that I had was that he fell down while taking a shower and became unconscious. But later on, when the authorities came and checked and found out that he was dead, it was really shocking.
Tara Goering still doesn't know what led to her father's decision. She says he was happy when he came to the U.S., but he did stress over paying bills and learning English. Ram Goering is the first reported Bhutanese refugee to commit suicide in New Hampshire, but one of at least 35 nationally. And for a group that's now about 72,000, it's the highest rate for any refugee population. The numbers trouble the Centers for Disease Control, which began investigating the deaths a few years ago. By early 2012, it had 16 cases to look at from a 3-year period. The CDC calculated a suicide rate higher than the national and global average, a rate that has held steady through last year.
The Bhutanese, and I think in general, just that part of the world, the perspective on suicide is very different from, I think, a lot of other populations and ethnicities.
Dr. Sharmila Shetty was a lead investigator on the CDC report. She says
the troubles surrounding the Groton Wind Farm all started in this man's front yard.
You better not be who I think you are.
Who do you think I am?
The assessor?
No.
This is Mario Rampino. He's a retired Boston police officer, and on a hill across the road from his house, the operations and maintenance building for Groton Wind towers over his house. It looks like a warehouse, surrounded with tall chain-link fences topped with barbed wire. Rampino's home used to be the last house on this dirt road.
It was just, if you could only picture, the road had to be 8 feet wide, all forested and quiet.
But then a couple of years ago came the O&M building, which, it turns out, was built in a different spot than Groton Wind's owner, Iberdrola Renewables, had originally proposed.
The building was supposed to have been up in the back, out of sight from everything.
After this interview was done, Rampino has since settled his issues with Iberdrola. But the movement of the building attracted the attention of a group of wind farm watchdogs. Cheryl Lewis and several others who'd been tracking the wind farm since it was proposed dug into the records and found that Iberdrola had made more changes to the positions of some of the roads and even turbines.
And nobody had seemed to notice that the building was put in the wrong place, that turbines weren't where they were supposed to, that, you know, the plans, building plans hadn't been received by the fire marshal and all that. And it's a very scary thought that all these things can take place without oversight.
Iberdrola says that oversight came from environmental regulators at DES. But the issue has galvanized Lewis and some of the wind.
In an interview at her Concord headquarters the day after her convincing primary win, Mara Linda Garcia restated her basic campaign theme. Incumbent Democrat Ann Custer should be defeated because she votes in lockstep with President Obama. And Garcia continued her sharp critique of the Affordable Care Act, saying she wants to dismantle it.
Obamacare and, you know, the effects it's having in all facets of our economy and access to care, and the way it was sold and on false premises. And yes, that directly comes from the top. It's the president, it's the administration, and it's those that support him unwaveringly.
But when asked about her own health care coverage, Garcia demurred.
That's my own issue.
Oh, so you don't want to say?
No, that's fine.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't need to share everything.
I bet it'll come up again. Probably something that the media will want to know.
Well, my constituents talk to me, and so I'm not here running on my own issues. I'm expressing what they come up with.
Is it fair to say you're not on getting your health care through Obamacare?
I don't need to talk about that. Thank you.
After that initial interview, Garcia's campaign said she is not enrolled for coverage through the Affordable Care Act. Considered a rising star by national Republicans, Garcia is a member of the New Hampshire House and a professional harpist who's taught music at area schools. But her campaign declined to say whether she is covered through any of those posts or provide any further details. All of the other Republican and Democratic candidates for New Hampshire federal office did provide information on their health coverage, which ranged from participation in the federal health care exchange to coverage through a spouse's employer to military benefits. For NHPR News, I'm Fred Bever.
There's a painted blue line surrounding the entrance to the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. Over that blue line, political campaigning is not allowed. But just a few inches this side of it, politics are in motion.
Today I stand here on behalf of the Medals Rights Council here at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard to formally endorse Congressman Michoud for governor of Maine.
Paul O'Connor is president of the largest of the four unions on the shipyard, all of which make endorsements. And as he's quick to say, 6,000 people work here each day, placing their votes in both Maine and New Hampshire. So let's just say this shipyard is a pretty tasty morsel for any number of candidates in the area. Down the road in Kittery at Town Pizza, a group of 8 shipyard workers eat pizza pies and place bets on NASCAR drivers, a weekly ritual.
All right, so 21, Chris.
Bernard.
Bernard.
A few from this crew say they vote Republican every time, but the majority on the shipyard vote Democratic. Take Kevin Gross.
Yeah, I'm a union pipe fitter.
Gross says the shipyard is a military installation, so people know better than to talk politics on the yard. But he says the unions almost always back Democrats, and he tends to follow their lead.
Yeah, I think they'd be looking out for our best interests, to be honest with you.
But while Democrats may have an advantage at the shipyard via unions, there's another group with a leg up come election time. That's incumbents, like Senator Jean Shaheen, who sits on the Armed Services Committee.
And I can tell you that we are working hard every day to ensure that the resources are there for all of you.
In September, Vice President Joe Biden visited the shipyard. He was accompanied by incumbents Jean Shaheen, Carol Shea Porter, and Maine Congressman Mike Michoud, who's now running for governor. They could address the workers because they were on official business, thanks to their current seats in Washington. But while campaigning on the shipyard is not allowed, Republican strategist Jamie Burnett says visits like that can seem kind of campaigny.
And I think that there are official events that can seem and look very political. But, you know, I suppose you chalk that up to trappings of incumbency.
Shaheen's opponent, Scott Brown, was actually born at a hospital on shipyard grounds. But he wouldn't qualify even for the full tour, let alone a speaking opportunity here. Of course, it's not just folks on the shipyard. Candidates are trying to woo.
This is NHPR's live coverage of the 2014 midterm elections. I'm Laura Kanoy. With me is political junkie Ken Rudin and UNH political science professor Dante Scala. We have results for several high-profile New Hampshire races, and we're following what's happening around the country as Republicans gain substantial ground in taking back the U.S. Senate. All that's coming up after this update on New Hampshire's elections.
It's 10:30, and I'm Brady Carlson with the latest results from election 2014 in New Hampshire. Good evening. Two of New Hampshire's top races have been called to remain. New Hampshire voters...
Everybody's just looking at the numbers, and, you know, Democrats say they're confident about the towns that haven't come in. I'm sure we might hear something similar among Republicans who are hopeful for a Scott Brown win, but there's some chanting starting up. Can't hear exactly what it is, but, stay tuned.
We heard similar chanting at Scott Brown headquarters. Thanks, Josh, and we'll be back with you when there's something to report. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Dante, what do you make of this? How are we supposed to figure this out? You know, the Associated Press called it. They've always been a terrific source for us, but here we now seem to have a split race on the Shaheen Brown side.
Well, the thing to keep in mind is where the vote has been reported in so far. And we've seen a lot of Republican territory come in thus far. So there have been, over the past couple hours, more of the Republican vote, more of the Republican base has reported in those towns than the Democratic base. So that's one thing to keep in mind. And that's why, in a relatively close race as this is, why the race might be going back and forth. But let me go back to, I mentioned bellwether towns, towns that really don't lean much one way or the other, which are a good proxy for how the state's going. In every single bellwether town that we're looking at that's reported in so far, Gene Shaheen is performing well, where we'd project her to do not only 50% of the vote, but a bit better than that. So if there's this great comeback for the ages there, it's not showing up in the data, and what's most important is the data that's still out there remaining to come in.
Polls predicted this race would be tight, and for a time last night, even after media outlets had declared Gene Shaheen the winner, Scott Brown briefly held a slim lead. Yet by night's end, it was Shaheen and her backers savoring a win in a contest party leaders here and in Washington wanted dearly.
Tonight, the people of New Hampshire chose to put New Hampshire first.
From the moment Scott Brown moved to New Hampshire and signaled an interest in returning to the Senate, from the state where he owned a vacation house and lived as a small child, Shaheen and Democrats derided him as an opportunist. Brown and his allies, meanwhile, cast Shaheen, a former Senate colleague of Brown's, who's now won statewide election in New Hampshire in 5 out of 6 tries, as little more than a toady to President Obama. Voters were bombarded with these messages for weeks. All told, more than $46 million was poured into this race, the most expensive in state history. In his concession speech, Scott Brown said the voters had spoken and he got the picture.
You've got no business in politics unless you respect the judgment of the people. If you run for office, you've got to be able to take it either way. I accept the decision of the voters, and I have already offered my sincerest congratulations and good wishes to Senator Shaheen.
Scott Brown shot to national attention when he won the Massachusetts Senate seat left vacant by the death of Ted Kennedy. In 2012, he lost to Elizabeth Warren. Last night, Brown called himself lucky to live in New Hampshire. He also said he was glad Republicans elsewhere achieved something he was fighting for, to flip the U.S. Senate to GOP control.
And regardless of what happens here tonight, I have one thing that has come true, that Harry Reid is the minority leader.
Gene Shaheen, for her part, listed priorities, an energy policy based on efficiency and limiting fossil fuels, a higher minimum wage, equal pay for equal work, and abortion rights that are unlikely to be shared by the Senate's new Republican majority. But Shaheen also promised to seek common ground.
I will work with anyone in the Senate, Democrat, Republican, Independent, to get things done to help New Hampshire's working families and our small businesses.
Scott Brown's future remains a work in progress and likely the subject of continued speculation here and nationally. Prior to getting into this race, Brown indicated to voters in Iowa he hadn't ruled out a future presidential run. Last night, Brown indicated ambitions a bit more modest.
I'm going to go have a beer and go get some rest and hit the gym tomorrow and play the guitar and spend some time with the families.
Ambitions well within his grasp. For NHPR News, I'm Josh Rogers.
It is no big secret that football, from the NFL down to Pee Wee leagues, has a concussion problem. And there are lots of efforts out there to fix it. New helmets, softer turf, gentler tackling rules, even diagnostics on the field to identify concussions right after a hit.
But there's been very little focus on actually what's at the root of it, changing the technique.
Eric Swartz is a UNH professor of kinesiology, which is the study of human movement. In the locker room during a Wildcats practice, he told me his idea to have players practice without helmets came from his time playing rugby.
If you think about it, you know, a better helmet, for its technology to work, actually requires that there's an impact to the head. You keep your head out of the way in a tackle in rugby because it's not protected. It'll hurt.
Swartz's hypothesis, if you give football players a sort of rugby awareness, they'll be more likely to think about where their heads are and keep them out of harm's way. Here's how the study works.
Head! Go get it! Go get it!
There are two study groups, each with 25 players. The control group practices with a helmet. And then...
I take my helmet off for practice.
So okay.
I'm in that group.
Okay.
Donald Goodrich is a running back, and he's in the treatment group. By the way, he had a concussion playing football during his freshman year.
Everything kind of started spinning on me a little bit.
Both the control and treatment groups get a little sensor placed behind their ears. That measures impacts to the head during practice or a game. And during practices, for really only a few minutes, both groups run through a tackling drill.
All right, well, when we take off our helmets, we go through basically what a defensive tackling drill would be.
You want to talk about getting in an athletic position?
That's head coach Sean McDonald, or Coach Mack. Athletic position is squatting, arms braced, head forward, facing another player who's holding a big padded shield.
Again, get that head out of it. Keep the leverage.
The treatment group takes their helmets off for this drill.
The biggest thing that we talk about is keeping the eyes and head up.
We have coaches constantly, nagging at us.
Eyes up, eyes up, please.
Get those eyes up. The second time you did it, I said, head.
And then you want to tackle chest to chest, not leading with your helmet or your face.
Run, 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 run. Right to that white. Here we go. We're out. We're out.
Lock!
After this very short drill, which they've been running during practice for months, the helmets go back on. The big idea is to simply get players to look where they're going and not hit with their head, neck, or shoulders. Over time, the theory is the treatment group will have less head trauma than the control group. Back in the locker room, Swartz shows me the science.
So this is the software interface, and we're looking at one day of impacts for one of the players.
That's one day?
It's one day.
This is like a little head with arrows pointing at it, arrow showing one hit to the head.
Yeah, and the color roughly portrays the magnitude of the impact.
This one player in one day took 45 hits to the head. Swartz can drill down further. He can graph each individual hit to the noggin. And each hit shows up as a spike. The graph shows how quickly head trauma can happen, in just tenths of a second. Not only that, Swartz measures the intensity of the hits in G-forces. When a football player gets a concussion, he's taking a hit twice the strength of an F-16 pilot in a jet roll. Here's that same hit you just heard, slowed way down. Football's head trauma problem isn't just about big hits. It's also about repeated hits over time. Of the 45 hits this player took on this one single day, 9 of them were hard hits to the head. The NFL is paying attention to the hard science happening on the Wildcats field. The league, GE, and Under Armour funded Swartz with a $500,000 grant. And here's what's really interesting. 19 of the 20 researchers given these grants are making stronger gear and better concussion diagnostics. No one but Swartz is trying to change behavior to address a basic human desire to protect yourself in a sport where huge men try to flatten one another.
If you look on the sidelines, let's say after there's a touchdown in football, oftentimes the players will headbutt themselves to celebrate. They probably wouldn't do that if they didn't have a helmet on.
Swartz will have the chance to test this theory as he expands the study into three high schools next year. For NHBR News, I'm Jack Rodolico.
A recent headline in my local paper, the Portsmouth Herald, reads, McDonough questioned about sex, lies, and duct tape. The story is a tragedy. A young woman died. The details are upsetting. Yet, I just read the article top to bottom. Why?
Well, because it's so lurid. Who would expect it in Portsmouth, New Hampshire? That's like a novel. That's like Hannibal Lecter.
I found Marlene Allen walking down the street in Portsmouth. It sounds like I'm not the only one compelled to read every word. Glenn Sabaluski is digital news editor for the Herald's SeacoastOnline.com.
We can see the page views. We can see how many people are reading the stories. Anybody in the public who goes to our website can see that they're dominated by the story.
In case you have managed to avoid learning the details of the trial, here they are according to the testimony of Kat McDonough, Seth Mazzalia's ex-girlfriend. Mazzalia and McDonough were seeking out a sadomasochistic threesome. McDonough brought her coworker from Target, UNH student Lizzie Marriott, to their apartment in Dover. McDonough says Mazzalia murdered and raped Marriott before they both deposited her body in the Piscataqua. But since no body has been found, there's little hard evidence. The defense disagrees with that version. They argue Kat McDonough is responsible for the murder. Here's Channel 5 in Boston.
Prosecutors say Lizzie Marriott was not a willing participant in three-way sex the night she died. Catherine McDonough was there. She says her boyfriend, Seth Mazzalia, was the master, she the slave. When he wanted
the court's information officer, Carol Alfano, says the courthouse hasn't seen this many reporters since the Pamela Smart trial in 1991. Four newspapers and nine TV stations, including CBS's 48 Hours and Dateline NBC, covered the initial testimony. Six outlets have stuck around for the long haul. Here, where the murder took place, the Portsmouth Herald has had one of its five reporters on the case full-time for almost a month.
We have a page one meeting every day where we look at all the stories that we have from across the region.
Executive editor Howard Altshuler says stories get above-the-fold placement based on one metric. Are they compelling?
I think it's very compelling. You're hearing things like breath play and steel kisses and the roles of dominance and submissives and switches and all this kind of thing. You know, I've been doing this for 27 years. I've never seen a case like this. I've never seen a trial like this.
The details are playing out in daily installments like Law and Order meets Quentin Tarantino.
And we shouldn't lose sight, of course, of the fact that there's a tragedy at the core of this.
Joshua Myrowitz teaches media studies at UNH, not psychoanalysis. But he says there's probably more to our collective captivation than meets the eye. On the one hand, he says, Kat McDonough and Seth Mazzalia look like our neighbors, our friends. We see our own lives projected onto a narrative usually reserved for TV. But it's also comforting, he says, that it's them ensnared in this tragedy, not us. And we can see every twist in the testimony streaming live online.
You need to explain to the jurors what's going through your mind in the bathroom.
I didn't have anywhere I could go. And I loved him. I didn't want to lose him.
But then, Myrowitz says, McDonough and Mazzalia's story also challenges us.
Because there are aspects of private sexual behavior that are funky and fun and that make life rich, and they exist on purpose outside of the eyes and ears of strangers. And this case kind of raises the question of where's the line?
However captivating, Myrowitz worries, with so few local reporters left these days, having more than six outlets at the trial every day for a month could have negative consequences.
This story, I think, pushes out a lot of the other reporting that the resources could be used for to tell us what's happening in our area.
At the Portsmouth Herald, executive editor Howard Altshuler disagrees. He says this happened in our community.
It gives the audience, the people who've followed this story and mourned the loss of an innocent life, some context to understand what happened. And even if it seems horrific and heartless, at least you know what the story is behind the story.
And, you know, it's compelling. For NHPR News, I'm Emily Corwin.
New Hampshire lawmakers are wading into the debate over the controversial new painkiller Zohydro. They've been hearing testimony today on a proposal that would impose an 18-month moratorium on the drug, which hit the market in March. NHPR's Brian Walston has been reporting on Zohydro and has an update from today's hearing. Welcome.
Hi, Brady.
Describe this drug. What is Hydro 4 and how is it different from other painkillers?
So Hydro is pure hydrocodone. Other hydrocodone formulations like Vicodin also contain acetaminophen or ibuprofen. I mean, they're what's known as short-acting opioids. They're very effective in treating moderate or severe pain that lasts a few days. Now, Zohydro is an extended-release formulation for pain that's severe enough to require daily around-the-clock treatment, essentially when nothing else works.
And are doctors in this state prescribing Zohydro?
Yeah, although it's hard to say how widespread it is at the moment. I spoke with a pain management specialist on the Seacoast who says he started to prescribe it to patients who are in continuous pain and that he'll continue to do so when it's appropriate. On the other hand, Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center has said it won't be adding Zohydro to its drug formulary. The head of the pain management center there told me there was no real need for it. And at least two Vermont hospitals have also said they won't stock the drug.
Now, State Senator Andy Sanborn is behind the legislative push here. Why are he and others calling for a moratorium?
Well, as you know, Brady, like a lot of states, New Hampshire has a prescription drug abuse problem. There were 200 drug-related deaths in 2011.
My first car was a 1936 Coupe DeVille. At least, that's what I told myself. I was 11 years old, and my Coupe DeVille was a crumpled wreck of an abandoned car locked in a thicket of trees with no road in sight. The seats were gone, tires gone, windows gone. Its story was gone, too. I'd sit inside and spin the wheel, make those driving sounds the kids make, and wonder, where had my Coupe DeVille come from, and how had the whole forest grown up around it? I've been a fan of abandoned things ever since. So when, while skiing recently in Crawford Notch, I came upon an abandoned train, three coaches, a swayback flat car, and a coal car, I had to climb aboard to take a look. Abandoned things can look burned out, even without any sign of fire. There's a smoke and cinder quality, as though time itself was a kind of incinerator. I didn't make the train sounds as I once would have, but the three coaches still had a few surviving seats, and I sat in each car and imagined the country flashing by and the knocking hustle of the wheels. When I was 11, I couldn't find out the story of my abandoned Coupe DeVille, but I wondered if I could find out more about the abandoned train, and who better to ask than a local railway man. Gordon Lang is a train conductor on the Conway Scenic Railroad and has passed the abandoned cars countless times on his way to Fabian Station. He says the Conway Scenic Railroad bought the cars in the late 90s.
There was five of them. Two of the cars are in use today. Some of them were Erie cars, some were Lackawanna cars.
The abandoned cars, Lang says, were electric and mounted with a pantograph that glided below power lines through Pennsylvania, New York, and New Jersey. And though he's been a train conductor for nearly 40 years, Lang didn't start off as a railway man. In 1971,
I pulled into the old North Conway post office, which is the brick building by the railroad station. And there sat a big old steam engine. The old 7470 was being pushed into the roundhouse for the first time. And everybody standing there looking at it. So I walked over. That was my downfall.
1971 was also the year of the first glimmerings of what would become the Conway Scenic Railroad.
White Smith had the equipment. Cal Reed and Bill Levy had bought the land, the buildings and stuff, and didn't know what they were going to do with them. So the three of them got together, and August 4th of 74, we made our first trip to Conway. It took 3 hours to make the round trip because the cylinder cocks kept opening with the brush. Then people saw us that Sunday and said, we want to go. Dwight says, we may get you there, but you may not get back. And so the first public runs was Sunday the 5th.
40 years later, and the Scenic Railroad is busier than ever. After talking to conductor Lang, I ski back over the snow-covered tracks to the Erie and Lackawanna cars. To climb aboard an abandoned train is to shift out of time. It isn't now, it isn't then, and this leaning together in time is part of the attraction. But equally drawing is the mystery about what such abandoned things are, what they become. To repurpose a line from the writer William Gass, this train has been abandoned, but it has been abandoned to beauty. It is no longer a train. It is itself. For NHPR, I'm Sean Hurley.
Freight train, run so fast. Freight train, run so fast. Please don't tell what train I'm on. They won't know where out.
It's 4:04. This is New Hampshire Public Radio News. I'm Brady Carlson. Good afternoon. With her re-election behind her, Democratic Governor Maggie Hassan's second term comes with the challenge of working with a Republican-led legislature and executive council, as NHPR's Michael Brindley reports.
During her campaign against Republican Walt Havenstein, Hassan often said her opponent's fiscal policies would take the state back to the, quote, devastating Bill O'Brien era. With Republicans taking control of the House Tuesday, the governor may now have to work with the former House Speaker should he reclaim the post. Speaking Wednesday in front of the State House, Hassan said it's time to move past any attacks she made in the heat of the campaign.
Elections really do focus on distinctions. Governing is about finding common ground. I'm willing to work with anybody who is willing to work with me and other legislators in both parties. It does take two to have a bipartisan approach.
Further complicating things for Hassan will be a 3-2 GOP majority on the executive council after Republican David Wheeler claimed retiring Democrat Deb Pignatelli's seat on Tuesday. The council must okay the governor's appointments to head state agencies, as well as any judicial nominations and major state contracts. For NHPR News, I'm Michael Brindley.
In the U.S. Senate race, Jean Shaheen held off a challenge by Republican Scott Brown in one of the nation's most closely watched U.S. Senate campaigns. In the 1st District, Republican Frank Ginta will return to Congress. He unseated incumbent Democrat Carol Shea Porter yesterday. Appearing this morning on The Exchange, Ginta promised to move on from the partisanship of the election and work across the aisle.
That should be the goal of everyone after hard-fought campaigns. We have an obligation and a responsibility to govern, and that's my pledge to the people of the state.
Partly clear weather this afternoon in New Hampshire. Clouds set to return tonight. Tomorrow, rain likely, mostly in the afternoon. This is NHPR News.